Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point.
And we'll use that one.
We're using it now, gringo.
Don't call me a foreigner. Last time I checked, the colors of the flag weren't red, white, and burrito.
Vince Vaughn, portraying a gritty, down-on-his-luck mechanic inciting a prison yard brawl with Hispanic inmates. Brawl in Cell Block 99 is a tour de force of violence, extortion, revenge. You might call it a grindhouse film. But is it also populist entertainment? Our guest, the movie's producer, Dallas Saunier, says yes. Films like The Shape of Water and Call Me By Your Name may clean up on the awards circuit, but Saunier has ditched Hollywood for Texas to make movies that appeal to other Americans, you might even say forgotten Americans. This hour on Point, entertainment in the age of Trump. You can join us on air or online. Has Hollywood become a liberal echo chamber? Does its output leave you cold? When you hear the phrase populist entertainment, what does it mean to you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll discuss the NFL's decision to fine teams whose players kneel on the field during the national anthem. But first, stereotypes, political correctness, and making movies in a polarized political environment. Joining me now from Dallas, Texas, is Dallas Saunier, a film producer making entertainment in the age of Trump. You can find trailers for two of his recent films on our website, onpointradio.org. Dallas Saunier, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
What's on the drawing boards? What can we be expecting in 2019 in our theaters from your shop?
We have a film coming out later this year called Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, which is a reboot, a reimagining of the 1989 horror film franchise. And we have a Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn movie coming out via Lionsgate at the end of the year called Dragged Across Concrete.
Are these movies that wouldn't be made in the normal way that movies are financed, assembled, casts are assembled, scripts assembled in Southern California?
Yes. Typically, in the studio system at least, and even in the independent worlds out in Los Angeles, you find what we call script by committee. And what happens is a screenplay will be written by a very talented writer, and then it will be put through several processes of filtration and diffusion. And what comes out the other side is something that has been it's been changed, it's been altered, it's been compromised. And we like to stay out of the writing room as much as possible, let the writers write, let the directors direct, and we believe what comes out the other end is something more authentic.
The Littlest Reich has some Nazi themes, isn't it? Doesn't it have that?
So it's about a group of villainous puppets that are created by a Nazi experimenter back in the 40s, and they've come to life in a small Texas town. Now they're essentially collector's items from a long time ago, and when they all come together at a convention, at an auction, they reanimate and start to kill people.
Now, as the producer, do you have to worry a little bit that making a movie about murderous Nazi puppets is a little bit like trying to handle a very volatile chemical, like trying to handle kryptonite?
Sure. I mean, we're thoughtful in our approach. We understand the controversies that we're walking into a lot of times. But we're thoughtful, and we take time to think things through. And but at the end of the day, we are independent, and because we are independent, nobody can tell us, "Oh, you can't make that movie," or "How dare you do that?" Or anything like that. We raise our money independently. We operate as an independent production company, and our movies do very well. So at the end of the day, it's commerce for the distribution companies, and we argue that you know, just because we're making movies that are that don't hold back and that don't worry too much about how they'll be received in terms of controversy, we believe that the product becomes a genuine product and that people respond to it.
In the 2017 film, Brawl in Cell Block 99, produced by our guest, Dallas Saunier, Vince Vaughn's character, Bradley Thomas, is arrested after two associates are killed during a drug pickup gone bad. During the firefight, he assists the police, which Detective Watkins, played by Clark Johnson, alludes to during their interview.
I saw how you took down those lowlifes when they went up against the police, even though you could have got away clean. I knew before you told me that you got an American flag in your home, you probably got more than one.
I got two.
Because of your selfless actions, no police were killed in that event, which tells me that you know the difference between right and wrong and that you have a moral compass.
But Vince Vaughn goes to prison anyway. Is this a movie that really wouldn't be made in the conventional studio system?
We shared it with several people in the studio system, and the notes came back the exact same from everybody. Tone down the dialogue, tone down the violence, and shorten the movie. The movie is over 2 hours long. And in the case of Brawl, we had between Vince Vaughn and Don Johnson and our financiers, we had enough value to proceed on our own. And so, yes, to answer your question, yes, it would have been shortened and toned down, and we weren't interested in making that version of the movie.
Just before we came on the air, I checked the top 10 box office movies for 2018 because I wanted to figure out where the contrast was. I don't know a lot about the movie business, but here are the top 10. Black Panther, Avengers Infinity War, Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle, A Quiet Place, Deadpool 2, Ready Player One, The Greatest Showman, Peter Rabbit, Star Wars Episode 8, and A Wrinkle in Time. There's a lot of, I think, very accessible fare there. If anything, it's a little skewed toward younger movie viewers than somebody who's actually past their 30th birthday. But, you know, plenty of violence in these movies, cumulatively. Whether it's the incredibly tense and frightening violence of A Quiet Place or this computer-generated world of Avengers Infinity War or Black Panther, this lineup of popular Hollywood movies is what, found wanting? You want to create something else for a different niche of viewer?
I think that the difference between – and I like a lot of those movies, and a lot of those movies were produced by some of my close friends. And I think what we're trying to do is establish our own corner. Yeah, our own niche. I mean, we're not trying to compete on 3,000 screens with the Avengers. I mean, that is not our business model and it's not our goal. What we're trying to do is create – movies that absolutely do not compromise, that do not pander in any regard. We have kind of a BS meter, if you will, and once we start to feel like we're compromising something, it doesn't feel like us anymore. So I enjoy those films, the top 10 films, as an audience member. That's actually I'm almost operating in a different business than those people. In those films, and I have a great respect for those movies. What I want to do is create an alternative to those films, which are very independent and simply just don't follow the traditional Hollywood structures.
Is there a forgotten audience out there that you can make money off of, stimulate, entertain, bring into the multiplex in the nearby regional mall that that just isn't being reached or being thought about when the movies like the ones I just named are being packaged or assembled?
Sure. Yes. And some of our audience would prefer to watch the movie at home. And a big part of our business model is monetizing the secondary windows of VOD and digital downloads and DVD Blu-ray and what we call SVOD, which is streaming VOD, which is predominantly Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, and Shudder. But we try to monetize those spaces because the margins are really strong for us there, and we find that our audiences like to discover these movies. They're discoveries for them. So it's hard for us to compete with the marketing dollars or the big budget spectacle of a Marvel film. So instead of going head to head on Friday night in the movie theater and asking the audience to choose us over them, we're happy to be the movie that they watch when they get home from the Avengers.
And now there's a reliable road toward making back your nut, isn't there?
Correct.
In Netflix and other streaming services, in the other ways that people can watch movies, there actually is a way for that dollar to find its way back to you and the corporation that's created to make that movie?
Correct. There's too much product right now in the marketplace for everyone to survive. And so our movies are they're specifically chosen because we believe that they will make a mark in the marketplace, that they will find their way through the noise. But yes, we definitely miss Blockbuster. I was not in the business back in those days, but yes, the increase of Netflix and things like that has helped.
We're discussing popular entertainment in the age of Trump. You can join the conversation. Has Hollywood become too politically correct? Too heavy-handed? Are you sick of movies with an agenda? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're looking at populist entertainment and filmmaking in today's polarized political climate. You can join the conversation. Do controversial movies exaggerate our political divides? Is this just as simple as seeing a gap in the market and making product to fill it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. During his inaugural address, President Trump said that day, January 20th, 2017, would be remembered as the day people became rulers of the nation again.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. Everyone is listening to you now.
In this scene from Brawl in Cell Block 99, Vince Vaughn's character laments the unfairness of life, using the metaphor of walking into a gas station for coffee and having to choose between milk, skim milk, and cream from unlabeled containers.
First container I grab is always that milk or that skim stuff. It's never the one I want. The law of averages says one out of three times I ought to get the cream, but it doesn't happen. Maybe if I go in there 1,000 times, it'll even out like it should, and I'll have a run of picking out the cream, you know, 50 or 100 times in a row, but I don't think so. I don't think things even out here like that.
My guest today is film producer Dallas Sonnier, who makes movies he describes as populist that speak to the world between New York and L.A. We'll go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hello, Ray. How are you today?
Okay.
I'd like to explain to your guest that he's making a compromise by the style of movie he's choosing from the very beginning. So it's no wonder the BS, he can't, you know, see, or he doesn't let his BS meter get full because it's full from the beginning. He's compromising on any kind of intelligent thought, at least from the examples he's given. I mean, it goes out of its way, the first example goes out of its way to say that the man owns two American flags, and I only know one kind of political ideology that equates your level of patriotism with how many American flags you own.
So, Aaron, if I understand the complaint, you're saying it's just weighted on the other side. If the complaint is that movies that are being made are weighted too much to one side, this just weights on the other side. Well, isn't that recognizing that part of the marketplace wants to see that?
Well, that's fine, but don't come on a radio show saying that you're not making compromises. The truth is what matters here, or the way that you're expressing yourself. And being dishonest from the beginning is not a good way to go.
Dallas Sonnier?
Yeah, there's nothing dishonest about me, and there's nothing compromising about me. But, Aaron, I completely respect your opinion, and I think that's what it is, your opinion. I have mine, and you have yours, and I'm not going to tell you how to live, and you're not going to tell me how to live.
Farmington, Connecticut is our next stop. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ray. My first observation before I get to what I want to make, which is about the way the section was initially introduced, is you're making exploitation movies. In the 70s, they were called blaxploitation or sexploitation. Their emphasis was on violence. It sounds to me like this emphasis is on violence. But the larger point I wanted to make is populism is an honorable tradition in American life and in American cinematography. You want to see a populist movie, you watch The Grapes of Wrath and Henry Fonda and Tom Joad, who actually gives up his life for something that matters, who stands in a line and says, hey, one out of three times I should get regular milk. That's not populism. That's just frustration expressing its result in violence. And that's all I had to say. Now, if anybody wants to ask a follow-up question, that's fine.
Well, Bob, I'm just curious, if that frustration is out there in the country, should movies express it?
I think that the blaxploitation movies of the 70s didn't express black rage. They implemented it. I think that the sexploitation movies of the 70s were, frankly, just sex movies. And I haven't seen one of these movies, but I think that somebody who walks into prison and picks fights and says, hey, you know, it's because I didn't get regular milk, I only got skim. That's demeaning what it means to be a citizen of the United States of America.
Thanks a lot for your call, Bob from Farmington, Connecticut. Emily's with us now from Chester, South Carolina. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Ray. I agree strongly with the previous two callers that basically, if you're playing to the lowest common denominator, you're lowering the threshold for what's acceptable. And just because some people think Nazism or playing to racism or latent hatred of immigrants is acceptable doesn't mean we should accept that as society and promote it. It's the same sort of mentality that Jerry Springer, you know, lowered the threshold for America of what was acceptable. And it's led to a dumbing down of America when we embrace these, what you're guest is calling populist, but really in a lot of ways are base interests for the lowest common denominator. It lowers everything. And that's, you know, that sort of pandering to lowest common denominator led to things like Trump as president.
Is it pandering or is it just answering the audience's appetite
for wanting to go to a movie where they see a protagonist who they feel they relate to or associate with.
Then should we make movies for the people who want to see Nazi heroes? Should we make movies who want to see racist heroes in their movies? It's the lowest common denominator. It's the worst sort of thing to say, okay, yes, your hatred, your bigotry, your bias is okay. You know, he may say the left does the same thing in media, but we're lifting up ideals like equality, egalitarianism, you know, social equity. We're not lifting up, you know, racists.
Emily, thanks a lot for your call. Dallas Saunier?
Yeah, let's get the train back on the track here. So the devil's always in the details. These callers have not actually seen the movies. So what they will find when they watch the movies is I believe they will be caught off guard by the strength of the characters and the dialogue and the situation. So in the case of Brawl in Cell Block 99, Vince Vaughn is protecting his family. He's not walking into the prison and picking fights with people simply because he didn't get the cream. So when you single out these moments, these clips in the movie, sure, these audience these callers can focus on what they're hearing, but in the grand scheme of things, the movie is actually incredibly well made. We got a standing ovation at the Venice Film Festival, which is one of the fanciest film festivals in the world. And we have an above 90% rating on Rotten Tomatoes for the film. And I would surmise that most film critics didn't vote for Donald Trump. So all I can say to your listeners is I appreciate their opinions, but they should see the movies.
South Windsor, Connecticut is next. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ray, how are you today?
Okay.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent.
Great. So I'm actually a filmmaker myself. I live in Connecticut. I lived in New York and L.A. for 14 years. Dallas, I'm a big fan of your work. I watch your films. You're getting a lot of calls in about how he's compromising. There's not real compromise happening here. The only one that can decide if someone's compromising is the person that's putting themselves out there to do what they're doing. And it's ironic to me that people that are calling in may have compromised their entire existence by not following their dreams and doing what they love to do. So, Dallas, I commend you for continuing to do what you're doing and finding success in it. I also, on a second note, find it curious that the conversation is about who's sitting in the White House is determining what we're doing for filmmaking on an independent level. It's not a concern of mine who was voted into office when finding an audience, unless I'm specifically going after a political statement in my piece. Do you know what I mean?
Well, correct. Yeah, right. But we're also talking about gaps in the marketplace and a center of cultural production, you might say, Southern California, that by some people's lights is not meeting the needs of the population overall.
I think to add to that, you know, I moved to Dallas. I grew up in Dallas and I moved back to Dallas in January of 2015. So Trump had not even announced his candidacy yet. And I wanted to move back to Dallas because I didn't feel like I was at home in Los Angeles. And you can say that was for political beliefs or cultural beliefs or whatever it is. But for me, I just wanted to go home. I lost both of my parents in really intense domestic gun violence situations and separate events. I went through and sat in the courtroom for over 40 days, over three trials. I mean, I've been to hell and back. And I just wanted to go home. And what I found when I went home was a neighborhood and a community and support that I just didn't find in my communities in Los Angeles. So it was a great move for me. And I don't make movies for the Trump audience. I think that's become the way to sell newspapers and to make sure that people listen to radio programs. So I'm not gonna sit there and fight the headline here, but because my movies do well. Very well with the audience of people who probably voted for Donald Trump. But what we're making is we're making movies that are not filtered through a Hollywood lens. And that's the point I'm making here.
What films would you use as examples to further flesh out that explanation? Examples of Hollywood output that's doing that?
Well, I think that when you have the studio system and you send them a great script. Remember, I was a talent agent and manager for over a decade, and my job was to set up projects. And I would sell a script to a studio. It would be really, really extremely well written. And over time, there would be compromises that would be made. So I don't want to give any examples because I really respect all the people who make these movies, because making movies is really hard. But we just felt like we had a different way of doing it that could not happen within the studio system. And so that's why we left. That's why we left and started this this new company outside the gates.
Boston, Massachusetts is next. Naima, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
Hiya.
So I saw Brawl on Cell Block 99. I actually enjoyed the movie. I guess to give a quick brief on me, you know, I'm a 34-year-old black woman, live in Boston pretty much my whole life, and seeing the movie, I didn't feel like, oh, there are severe racist undertones. But what I really enjoyed about the movie is it didn't represent me or represent where I'm from or what I see in myself, but it gave me a point of conversation. And I'm a little concerned with censoring these type of movies, because we need to be able to have a conversation about how the whole country is living. And I think we're currently at a place where we're not having these conversations. So a movie like this actually starts the conversation, because I don't necessarily relate to what's going on in that movie, but I can relate to feeling, hey, I'm not getting enough from my country as a whole, or I'm underrepresented. And these are two commonalities that we can talk about even by just watching this movie.
So the movie didn't have to reflect your life, Naima. It gave you a way of looking into another kind of life.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that who I am is represented, you know, great in the media right now. However, being able to see another culture or another person's background, somebody else from another start of this, you know, another part of the country that I really cannot connect with, opens up dialogue.
So you'll see the next Dallas Saunier movie that comes to your movie theater in your neighborhood in Boston.
I mean, I'd absolutely be open to it if it's the movie that I'm interested in.
There we go. Okay. Naima, thanks a lot for your call. Al is with us now from Monroe, North Carolina. Al, welcome to the program. Hey, Al.
I'm kind of torn here. Everybody's talking about this movie from a, I don't know what you want to call it, a cultural, I guess, a reality kind of perspective. I'd just like to make the point that movies are art. And art is in the eye of the beholder. And there's a whole lot more to a movie than just the script, dialogue, what have you, and the actual acting. There's the cinematography, there are the effects, they're the camera angles. There's a lot of stuff going on in the movie that makes it really great, okay? And I guess my perspective on this is, being a frustrated kind of musician in part-time, is that just like in music, there are musicians that play for musicians. And the people that outside of that group that come in because you're doing things correctly is a benefit. And I feel as though that in a lot of ways, that's kind of what's going on here. I guess an example of that, and perhaps David Dallas would like to comment on it, is that it's been going on a long time. I'm a big, big fan of the movie Sin City, which is incredibly violent. And it's done in the most amazing way, which, you know, I'm not prescribing the actions, or I'm not supporting or condoning the actions of the individuals in the movie. But my God, what the content of that movie has and the way it's portrayed and all that, is amazing.
Let me get a comment. Thanks a lot for your call, Al. Let me get a comment from Dallas.
Yeah, I think Al is touching on some really smart points, as was Naima before him. And, you know, art is, in my opinion, art is intended to create a conversation. And that is why we make movies, to get people to respond and entertain them and get them to talk and all that kind of stuff. And just wait till you see Dragged Across Concrete, because it is going to spark that conversation even further. But I really enjoy entertaining people.
Dallas Saunier is the co-founder and CEO of the production company CineState. Dallas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, we'll look at the NFL's new policy about punishing teams whose players kneel during the national anthem. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the NFL's decision? Is it the right call or a kind of capitulation? I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day, and there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. Yesterday, the NFL announced it would fine teams if their football players protest during the national anthem. But according to the new policy, players can skip the pregame ceremonies altogether and stay in the locker room. You can join us on air or online. Is the NFL's new policy a good compromise, or does it stifle free speech? Should players face penalties for bringing politics onto the field? Register your opinion on Twitter and Facebook, our sites, On Point Radio. Let me give Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, a chance to clarify the policy, flesh it out for you. This is from a news conference announcing the policy change yesterday.
If anyone is on the field and is disrespectful to the anthem or the flag, there would be a fine from the league against the team. The team will have its own work rules, will be consistent with the overall policy, and they will make their own decisions about how to manage that.
Joining me now from Silver Spring, Maryland, is Kevin Blackistone, sports columnist for The Washington Post, an ESPN panelist, and professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. Kevin, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Ray.
What do you make of the compromise? Or is it a compromise?
Yeah, I don't think it's a compromise at all. I think Roger Goodell was kowtowing to the people who pay him something like $44 million a year, who are the owners of the league, specifically a handful of them. You know, as we know, it's certainly not a compromise because the players were not consulted on this particular issue. I think it's a joke. I think the NFLPA will take the league to court on this. And I think they have precedent in the Supreme Court, ruling back in the 1940s, which basically said you cannot compel someone to do the Pledge of Allegiance. So I certainly don't think you can coerce someone to perform at your wishes for the Star-Spangled Banner.
Well, they're not asking them to perform as much as asking them not to do anything.
Well, I think that's, to me, that's the same thing. What they want to remove from the field is any sign of protest, because what they're saying is that if you want to protest, if you don't want to stand at attention for the national anthem, then you can't be on the field. And if you are on the field and you fail to do so, then we will punish you monetarily.
Some owners have already made it clear that they'll pay their players fines.
Exactly.
Other owners were no doubt behind this new Goodell announcement. They wanted this stopped, and they wanted it stopped as quickly as possible. Many of the owners blame the sagging ratings and the sagging attendance at NFL games on these anthem-related protests.
Why not blame the continued use of police lethality against unarmed black men in this country as a reason for why players want to publicly protest before they go to work on the football field. Why not do that? Because these owners are feckless. We have this narrative out here that sports and politics don't mix. We have a narrative out here that the national anthem is about patriotism. But the truth of the matter is, and particularly after this ruling yesterday, is that the reason that the anthem is a part of professional football in the first place is because of politics. It's because of image. It's because of marketing. It's because of public relations. And there's not a sport in this country, and football is the largest one, that has done a better job at wrapping itself in the American flag as a way to sell its game as some sort of patriotic act, which is part of a ritual before games that includes militarism with flyovers and the presentation of the colors, as well as nationalism. And that's really what is going on here. And I am anxious to find out what the reaction of the players is going to be to this particular act, if they are going to be stirred up far more than they have been in the past to react to the way the league is handling this issue.
One person who has never publicly acknowledged that taking a knee during the anthem is a form of protest against police brutality in the United States is the president of the United States. In an interview taped yesterday that aired this morning on Fox and Friends, President Trump praised the NFL's decision to mandate that players either stand for the national anthem or stay in the locker room.
You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. Well, you shouldn't be playing. You shouldn't be there. Maybe you shouldn't be in the country. You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. And the NFL owners did the right thing if that's what they've done.
Apparently, not seeking to build this thing down, but build it up, he sees this, the president, as a test of your Americanism.
Wow. I mean, that was such a sophomoric analysis. I'm embarrassed to have to respond to it. Yeah, if you disagree with something in this country, you should get out. And I think James Baldwin had a pretty good retort to that, in which he said the one reason he loves this country is because you can challenge it to be better, and oftentimes it responds. Again, this is not about patriotism, and so many of these players put their lives in jeopardy to make a lot of money at this game, as well as to entertain the public. Many of them, if you talk to an NFLPA, come from military families. This, once again, is not about the military. They come from patriotic families. And this, once again, is not about patriotism. It is about an issue in this country of the way that police treat black men. And if anyone needs a reminder of that, you can look at the videotape that was released from Milwaukee on the day that Roger Goodell is standing at the podium to announce how black players, primarily black players in the league, are going to be handled should they want to protest. And you see the arrest on videotape of Sterling Brown, a basketball player for the Milwaukee Bucks, who happened to have parked his car across a couple of parking spots at 2 o'clock in the morning. Outside of a drugstore, and he winds up being tasered on his back and arrested. This is what has spurred the protest. This is what NFL owners should be concerned about. As white men, they should be concerned about the 70% of their laborers who are black and who oftentimes have to be concerned about their encounter with police.
Here's a comment from our website from Honest Debate. Too little, too late, he writes. I've been a football fan all my life. I used to go to games in Miami before Shula to watch Flipper in the tank in the end zone. I was a ball boy for a Dallas Rams game in the runner-up bowl. I was at the Super Bowl III and saw Namath slay Unitas when I was 9 years old. They're losing even me. Now I'm a Panther fan, and we just got a new owner who is virulently and vocally anti-Trump. I may be done. And from Twitter, Buckeye Chris writes, the NFL has chosen profit over principle and used a distorted sense of patriotism to justify it. Belcamp, Maryland is with us now. John, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Ray. Listen, I can appreciate the passion. I understand, and I agree about the enormity or the problem that exists out there, but that's not the team owner's problem. Like, it's not Jeff Bezos's problem or any other CEO's. It's not their problem. Their business is making sure that their audience is respected and continues to come to buy the product. So here's a solution. There's this guy named William Urey who wrote a book called Getting to Yes years ago. It's taught in all kinds of business schools. There's this idea of going to something called the balcony for a different idea, a fresh perspective. Here's a fresh perspective. What you do is you reframe the whole thing. And this is what the owners should have done yesterday. Instead of making it about the national anthem, they should have made it about the audience. The rule should say something like, teams and their players and their employees shall respect the paying public that comes to the stadiums to watch our games, should respect the people in the audience, whether it's in person or on television, by standing during all pregame ceremonies. That would solve it. Reframe it about the audience, because those are the people that are paying the bills. Those are the people that are getting angry, and those people are the ones who are staying away from the games.
Professor Blackstone?
Well, I would say I hear your sentiment, but I would also suggest that those fans are often the ones who are on their cell phones during the playing of the national anthem. They are in the beer line, being served beverages by employees of that franchise, which are looking to make money. Their behavior during the national anthem is not at all being policed, and they are not in all at jeopardy as to how they behave during the national anthem. So I take umbrage with the fact that it is the players who are being singled out in this particular issue.
Well, players are employees, just like someone pouring a beer, but they're also highly visible employees.
Yep,
they're on the field of play. They're on camera. They're on television screens across the country.
And, you know, the other thing about it is, and let me get back to the element of race here, because, you know, for so long in this country, no one has paid attention to issues of import to the black community unless they are voiced by entertainers, and in particular athletes, which is one reason why some of the most famous black athletes in the history of this country are those who not only excelled on the field, but found a way to use the field to say something about the issues affecting them and their communities. Even Jackie Robinson, who was lauded in this country for having turned the other cheek while so many in the game that let him play eventually spat in his face, even he said upon retirement that he found it difficult to stand with hand over heart and sing the national anthem. So this is an issue that's been going on for a very long time, and unless those who have that platform use it to say something very important or to bring attention to something very important, these things go unheard.
Portland, Maine is next. John, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Yes, calling from Portland, part of Patriots Nation and Celtics Nation. And I like what the professor is saying. I support the players who took a knee, and I feel that this action by NFL owners is anti-American, anti-free speech. Compelled respect is not American. And, you know, they really have lost me here. And I saw the Super Bowl with Namath. and I've been a fan since. Now, I've been concerned about concussions and injuries, and I've been thinking whether or not my values are consistent, but this would drive me out. What the NFL is doing, it would be the end of my watching the NFL. I am with those players, and I hope they have the courage to continue, and others who have something. Their protests were respectful and respected the nation and respected the audience, and I'm with them.
John and Professor, are you aware of any owner that's come out publicly to say, yes, I too worry about the violence against black men in America. I deplore it as well, but I'd prefer you stood during the anthem to try to separate the issues. Did any owner say to the 80% of their on-field employees who are black, no, I hear you. I recognize that this is a problem. Let's figure out how to oppose it. Anything.
Well, I think that Christopher Johnson, who is the acting owner of the New York Jets, while his father, Woody Johnson, a big contributor to Donald Trump's campaign, is now ambassador to England, came out in a statement yesterday and suggested much of the same thing, that he understood the concerns of the black players on his team, and he was not comfortable with this ruling by the NFL, and that, in fact, should any of his players wind up protesting on the sidelines and be fined, that he was going to be happy to pay their fine. So there's one who has stepped out of line with not only his father, but with the NFL owners who are really pushing for this kind of statement to be made.
Oh, the humanity, commented on our website. Kaepernick is a hero. He kneeled because another hero suggested it as an appropriate way to protest injustice. Kaepernick followed up his protest by being a man of his word and donating over $1 million to worthy charities directly relevant to his cause. Either you're for the First Amendment or you're not. Stop cherry picking, especially on this. It's more than a little racist. I'm sure we haven't heard the end of this, Professor.
No, we haven't, and it'll be interesting to see how this upcoming football season starts out. It'll be interesting to see how during this downtime, whether or not players how they come together, they coalesce around this issue. It is not going anywhere anytime soon.
Kevin Blackistone is sports columnist for The Washington Post, an ESPN panelist, and a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.